Reconvene the hearing. I've got a couple of questions out of the evidence first. On page 16 in paragraph 5.4, talking about the rural living zones, I'm just wondering if you've put your mind to purpose of and what controls or what matters should be considered with the size and location of residential building platforms in the rural lifestyle zone. I know you haven't specifically addressed that, Lewis.
No. And I was thinking that back in Rule 2756, subdivision design, which talk about subjective things like rural living character, where the building locations, building platforms could adversely affect adjoining more residential land uses. In addition to possibly matters that go slightly beyond the exact location of the building platform and more about something that goes on, like the height of a building and landscaping and so on, which are quite common in those zones as well as the rural zone.
Mm. Well, I suppose I was more fundamentally concerned about the rules provide for those things, but there doesn't seem to be any guidance provided either through policies or anything else as to A, why they're provided for, B, how they are provided. And I admit it's in the operative plan, it is no different, but I'm just wondering if you'll put your mind to that at all when you raise things that are generally dealt with. Or do we need to worry about building platforms in rural lifestyle zone?
Yeah. Well, again, my basic premise for me is that we're putting a line around that block of land, that zone, and saying that's for rural lifestyle, that's for rural residential. Meaning we're already agreeing that there will be effects on the environment from that land use. And then where you're going is inside that zone, do we need to manage those effects anymore? Other than location, which then relates to some wider issue of rural living character, landscape values and visual amenity, which can then be managed by other matters, as I said, like landscaping and specific issues about the building that goes into that building platform. I'm just trying to think of what other issues there would be that need to be further enunciated, whether in a policy or an assessment matter.
I
then are any policies in the subdivision chapter on that very point for those zones? Or are they in the zones themselves? And I suspect it's the latter.
Well, I have to say, Mr. Brown, from doing the rural hearings, I don't recall there being anything in the rural lifestyle zone on building platforms. There certainly are in the rural zone.
Yes. But I'm talking about the more generic aspects of that zone, like what are the qualities and attributes of that zone that are being promoted and are trying to be protected.
So, are you suggesting that the location and the size of the building platform should be to achieve the purpose of the zone provisions?
In broad summary, yes. And I'm just struggling to recall exactly what the objectives and policies of those specific zones are. I probably need to go back to them and just see what they're talking about, and if there's anything in your question that could be answered in those.
I think your answer is helpful, because I think it means that we have to then check that ourselves.
Right.
That equally is useful for us.
Okay.
While you're on that score, your interpretation of rural lifestyle zone is that it's accepting certain effects. As I read it, therefore the subdivision chapter is not an opportunity to roll back that acceptance. Maybe that the hearing panel on the rural chapters heard more material, I suspect probably did. That my understanding or recollection based on the evidence in the Street 1 hearing was that those rural residential and rural lifestyle zones were justified on the basis that the landscape could absorb residential development at the scale of rural lifestyle or rural residential, which is not quite the same thing as acknowledging it would have effects. And it may not take me anywhere different, but I'd just invite you to comment on that. I can't think of another issue other than location either, not at the moment, but I just wanted to put that alternative view to you.
So I'm understanding the alternative view, I actually think I'm saying the same thing as what you've put to me, is that there's a purpose of a zone,
and
there's landscapes which can absorb the development, which is the reason for those zones. Basically, that's the same as me saying that the effects of development in those zones is acceptable.
And the reason I look at it in the way that I do is that takes me to location. It's in this principle of saying there's a general acceptance that rural dwellings will be able to be absorbed in that area, but a corollary that there'll be a need to check the actual site suggested and the actual proposal, because it may need to be somewhere different on the site.
Correct.
In order to be consistent with the starting premise that the landscape can absorb that development.
Yes, and zeroing in a wee bit more on that, while the zone puts a line around a large area, there still may be points within that large area where a dwelling may not be acceptable or should be shifted a little bit to make it more acceptable. For example, to keep it off a skyline when viewed from a main road.
And in relation to where that takes me next is to think that the principle, the provisions say the building platform might be anything from, I think, 70 square metres to 1,000. I think I recall there's a proposed a discretion as to the size of the building platform. Does there need to be constraints as to how much of the building platform is in fact occupied? Because I can imagine that the argument would always be, well, until we've done some geotech, we need some flexibility as to where we're going to shunt this round, but no one's actually contemplating a 1,000 square metre building on the site.
Firstly, in terms of geotech, that's normally, in fact always, I can't think of a recent example, certainly since Christchurch, where geotech hasn't been a prerequisite for the subdivision application itself, for every building platform being proposed. So it's quite common now that we need to get a geotech engineer on board who can demonstrate that the location of that building platform, is going to be adequate geotechnically. And if it's not, then there's a problem, it needs to be shifted.
Does that mean that the size of the building platform should match the size of the proposed development? That there's no need for flexibility?
That's the second part of your question. It's still a controlled activity for the subsequent dwelling within that building platform. So that confers a right for a controlled activity application to put a building there, which can't be refused. But in that controlled activity process, the council's got various matters of control that can be managed if the building needs to be smaller or lower or landscaped or different colours and materials and so on. That's all fairly standard practice.
You're referring to the operative plan of the range?
Yes, I am. Yes. And I'm pretty sure a lot of those powers are still there in the proposed plan.
I think the difference in the proposed plan is it's permitted up to a certain size and then restricted.
Of course, yes. 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 Yeah. But even if there were to be an application promoted that builds out the building platform, still need to be assessed on its merits, and I'd need to go back and check in that zone, but I'm sure that there will be powers for a bit of a reduction or a shift or a colour change or more landscaping or a lowering or whatever. My experience is that can happen if necessary.
Well, I suppose that I completely agree that conditions could tweak it at the edges, but what that's suggesting to me is that the maximum size of the building platform should be what is actually envisaged to be constructed plus some reasonable margin, rather than starting at 1,000 and working down.
I think so. Are you then suggesting that the building plans and so on would be filed concurrently with when the building platform is proposed? Which is quite common.
Well, not necessarily, but I'm just aware that all over the Waikato Basin is currently 1,000 square metre building platforms identified but not yet constructed, and looking forward, if if there's not a geotech reason why you need lots of flexibility to shunt around within 1,000 square metres, that seems an awfully large area for a building, for a residential building at least.
I don't know of any examples where someone's tried to fill out their 1,000 square metres, but they've certainly gone stretched to the edges of it, but with the usual breakup of buildings, there's a piece here, a piece here, and a garage there, and different roof lines and so on. That's all fairly common. I can't think of any example where someone's tried to just build a 1,000 square metre floor plated building within a large building platform.
Thank you.
Can I possibly alert Commissioner Robinson to the fact that this is coming back to my issue of the same thing being dealt with by differently constituted hearing panels, but the Commissioner Officer should be aware that there's been evidence presented during the earlier hearing on the rural lifestyle zone addressing these direct issues, including justification given for 1,000 square metre building platforms on the grounds that encourages people to build lower single-storey houses rather than higher two-storey houses, and it gives scope to have two or three different elements and put your car park and your garage in and so on and so forth and so forth. There has been evidence made in the earlier hearing on the issue.
The reason I raised the issue, Mr. Goldsmith, is that in the rural lifestyle zone provisions, there is nothing to give any guidance as to the size and location of building platforms. And there seems to be nothing in the rural zone, the subdivision chapter. And that was the reason I raised the issue. And I understand there's a whole lot of land use aspects that go with that, which are covered, I think, in the
So just to let Commissioner Robson today, yes. There is other evidence directly addressing the questions he was asking.
Well, since I see Ms. Galloway has arrived, I can tell her that given that she's requested that I read all her rural evidence, I'll undoubtedly find it in due course, but I won't be doing that before tomorrow morning.
The other questions, you said you were happy to discuss with us the unitary plan provision from Auckland. Were you involved in the hearings on the subdivision chapters there?
No, I wasn't. I was involved in many other zones, and my comment there was more about how they've structured all of these zones.
Yes. Are you familiar with the chapters? The subdivision?
Only since I went to them, the recommended versions, over the lunch hour and printed them out, so I've had a brief squiz at them.
So you're probably as familiar as I am.
Yeah.
I suppose the real question is, in terms of the structure compared to the structure of Chapter 27 as notified, you can make any comments on those that might help us.
This unitary plan version more or less follows the order, the batting order, if you like, that I listed in my paragraph 5.5 of my evidence in chief, which is objectives and policies which set the direction, then some activity status rules, some development standard rules, matters of control or discretion, and then assessment matters, which follow the matters of control. They follow the same order. So if there's a matter of control for a certain matter, in that part of the plan, then there's equivalent assessment matters that correspond to that matter, and they go down sequentially. And I find that that's quite a tidy way of setting it out.
Okay. Did you have a chance to consider any of the wording of ignoring duplication of assessment matters and matters of discretion?
Yeah.
Did you have a chance to consider the matters of discretion and whether they are not necessarily appropriate, but they are within the bounds of what you would expect?
Look, I didn't read through them in any detail, but I'll just have a look at them now. I'm used to matters of control or matters of discretion being a clear statement of the matter in question.
Mm.
It directs you that's an issue, but then your assessment is based on all of the assessment matters. That's where the guidance is.
The other question, in your experience, you have an application for control activity and an application for a restricted discretionary activity. Is there any likely difference in the actual transaction cost?
In some cases, no. In some cases, it would depend on what the matter of discretion is.
Well, given if they were both exactly the same, the matters of control and the matters of discretion were the same things, it was only a matter of whether consent must be granted or consent
yes.
may be refused.
Generally not any real difference in transaction cost.
Right.
Comment in your last question, Commissioner, and it would be fact dependent. I'm just conscious that these days preparing a consent application contains this new requirement that persons and solicitors and governments know that a consent application addresses all relevant objectives and policies as a It's an AE of effects, and there's a whole new separate assessment of objectives and policies. And it may well be that the answer to your previous question could depend upon whether the RDA, depending how broad it is, how many additional objectives and policies it might bring into the equation and into the control. I'm just thinking aloud. Because control is usually fairly controlled activity, looking at assessment matters. Usually built to policies and objectives, whereas if there's a broad RDA, which again depends how broad it is, it may bring in other policies and objectives, which may have an effect on the cost of preparing an application. I just raise that as a possibility.
I did say they were the same matters of discretion as the matters of control, so they'd be the same. So if they were the same, termed in the same way,
right.
Then that follow.
So as I understood your question, it was essentially all other things being equal.
Yes, that was the point of my question, yes. I understand that if the matters of discretion are broader, they're much more complex.
Thank you very much.
Cool, Mr. Carroll?
Yes.
No summary this time, Commissioners, just Mr. Carroll's answering questions.
Thank you.
comments indeed. Questions?
Yes, thank you. I wanted to ask you to turn to paragraph 8F of your evidence, Mr. Farrell. You've cited the quality planning website as signalling that the use of the RDA is the default position for subdivision, not good planning practice. Can you point us to any precedents or the trend of precedents actually on the ground as opposed to what the Planning Institute said?
No, sir, that was just for your information. It's basically in response, there was a comment, I can't recall which one, in the section of the report which talks about good planning practice, and I thought it would be helpful for you to be aware of the quality planning website when it comes to, just in terms of what it says around control activity status and RDA status for some.
Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Snick?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Farrell.
That's the case for some of this. Commissioner, pleased to see we've managed to stay inside the time here.
Yes.
Timelines.
We're ahead of ourselves.
Not by overly much, so.
Yes, Mr. Colvin, you're ready.
Thank you. We'll start at bullet point 3. If you were...
Yes, that's fine. Okay.
Transport agency suggests it's important for the policy framework to highlight the need to involve other relevant agencies at the time of subdivision. For example, the Transport Agency has obligations under the Government of Motor Powers Act regarding access to and administration of limited access roads. It is advantageous to both developers and the transport agency if developers consult and consider those requirements earlier in the process. For this reason, the transport agency supported policy 27.2.1.6 and rule 27.10.1.1. Similarly, rule 27.9.2 identifies that the transport agency as an affected party to applications for resource consent where the subject site or activity adjoins or has access to a state highway. Transport agency supports integrated planning. Decisions about transport systems, the form of urban development, and how land is used all impact each other. Integrated planning seeks solutions to ensure the most efficient use of public funds and avoid creating unintended impacts. This is important because transport is a significant contributor to economic growth and productivity and a determinant of how well urban and rural areas function and quality of life offered. For this reason, the Transport Agency supported policy 27.2.2.4.
transparency submitted and supported objective 27.2.5, which highlights the need for infrastructure and services to be provided to accommodate anticipated building uses. Transparency suggests that it would be useful for the objective to indicate what standard of infrastructure and services will be required. For this reason, I suggest objective 27.2.5 should read, infrastructure and services are provided to new subdivisions and developments in anticipation of the likely effects of their use activities. Similarly, the Transport Agency also submitted in support of objective 27.2.6, which highlights that the cost of necessary infrastructure expansions and upgrades should be met by the supplier. The Transport Agency takes a whole-of-network approach to deliver transport solutions to the transport network. Consequently, the Transport Agency considers public transport and provisions for pedestrian and cyclists as important components of the transport network. For this reason, the Transport Agency supports policies 27.2.5.1, 27.2.5.2, 27.2.5.3, and 27.2.5.5.
Yes, I just want to clarify in paragraph 25 of your evidence, when you're talking about NZTA's powers under section 93 of the Government Road and Towns Act, that we take from this that even if the subdivision was a controlled activity, the Transport Agency's refusal of a certificate under section 93 would effectively allow the council to refuse consent.
I'm not entirely sure how they marry up. In terms of under the Government Road and Powers Act, the road is not a road for the purpose of the subdivision unless we say it is.
Right.
In terms of.
Can you repeat that, please? I didn't quite catch that.
In terms of section 93 of the Government Road and Powers Act, the road is not a road for the purpose of the subdivision unless the Transport Agency advises that it is. Having said that, we look closely at the rules and policies of the district plan and don't work separately from those. So if the subdivision is a controlled activity, then we may want to try and seek to have it in the best possible location, but it's unlikely that we would not issue a section 93 notice.
Right, so that sort of answers the second question I had, which was, does the activity status colour the agency's determination?
Definitely, correct.
And it may not be in your field, but as I was working through in my own mind your description, if the effect of the operation of Section 93 is that it's not a road for the purposes of the subdivision, unless you say it is, then Section 106 of the RMA would entitle the council to decline the subdivision because of a lack of sufficient legal and practical access.
That's my understanding.
Do you have any questions?
I had one question arising out of your suggested amendment to objective 27.2.5. It's a wording thing. I can understand why you're talking about effects of land use activities from the agency's point of view. But if you're looking at other infrastructure like electricity or telecommunications, water, sewage, effects won't cut it. There it's much more the demands an activity. or have, but would demands work on a traffic basis, or does it need to be both?
Demands and effects, I guess, are related. So the order of signalling here is I sort of help clarify that objective.
Yeah, I understand exactly what you're suggesting and why. It's just I'm thinking that while it works for the agency, it won't work for other infrastructure providers and will in fact limit the ability to ensure that appropriate infrastructure and services are provided to new developments.
To be fair, I haven't considered that. So.
Okay, so I'll ponder that.
Is what you're trying to say is that the infrastructure and services are provided at a scale and capacity in anticipation of the likely land use activities?
Yes. So what you reasonably expect to occur there after the subdivisions has occurred?
Yes. It's just the connotation of effect, of course, means, you know, reverse sensitivity effects, which I don't think you do intend.
No. I'm not an obvious
instance. No.
Just repeat what you said so I can write it down.
At a scale and capacity.
Likely land use activities on the site.
Within the site.
Within the site.
Mr. Stevens? Thank you, Mr. McCall. Sorry to bring you up here when the weather has not been so good.
No, that's okay. Thanks.
I take it they clear State Highway 1 before you say leave the meeting.
Yes.
I will adjourn the hearing until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.